to a new episode of the Monday Mile podcast. This week we're in central London with a lady who's about to hit the radio airwaves. She's one of those that has the voice for radio and the face for TV. She's a double threat, starting out in children's TV and being a staple of the CBBC family. She's a qualified journalist and author. She's the presenter of Radio 1 Life Hacks and now a face of the BBC Morning Live family. She also co-hosts Going Home with Vic and Jordan on BBC Radio 1, and we've just managed to catch her before she heads into the studio. Katie Thistleton, welcome to the pod.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. I'm so pleased this is actually finally happening. We've been trying to make this happen for a long time.
It has been quite a while, but you are a lady in demand. You are Manchester, London, Manchester, London, and we've managed to catch you here in Central today.
I know, it's so nice. As soon as I found out I was going to be down here for a week, which often happens, as you say, I'll often cover for Vic or Jordan whenever they're off. I was like, right, let's get this podcast in with Amy, because it's just, I love your podcast. It's so good to be able to have a chat with you.
Thank you. Are you much of a walker?
Do you know what? I'm trying to be. Trying to get my steps in, you know, and it's just kind of all the rage now, isn't it? To be like, you know, you don't have to do any really hard, intense exercise. You can do it all with walking. So I'm trying to be better. And especially now it's nice weather at the moment. I'm trying to, like, you know, you have those like half an hour hours where you just sort of sit on your phone, do your emails or scroll through TikTok or do your messages, voice note your mates. I'm trying to like go out of the house and do that on a walk rather than sitting on the sofa doing it. So that's my new thing that I try and do. It doesn't happen every day, but I'm getting better at it.
That's the theory behind this as well. In lockdown, we spent so much time sat stationary, speaking to people over Zoom. I'm like, why don't we just get out and walk?
Yeah, absolutely. It became such a thing, didn't it? And me and my mates realised, like, what a great healthy way of catching up, because normally we'd go for like lunch and we'd sit in somewhere and we'd like be tempted to eat loads of food that perhaps we don't want to eat, and or drink, maybe go out for dinner and like drink alcohol. And then we started doing the walks because we had to in lockdown. It's the only thing you could do.
Yeah.
And now we're sort of trying to keep that going, because it's just a, it's like a triple whammy, isn't it? It's like healthy because of the exercise, you catch up with your mates, you go out in nature. It's just, it's all good. It's all good for the mind.
It is. Now, we've sort of first met through BBC Radio 1 Life Hacks. Uh-huh. I was lucky enough to come on your show.
Oh, we were very lucky to have you.
In fact, twice. Yeah. And I absolutely loved it. Now, that show really is a mashup of incredible open conversations. Being the host of that, have you learned quite a bit about yourself and your own approach to mental health?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I was already really into mental health kind of from being on kids telly, really, was when I first started getting into that subject. I was kind of working with quite a few like children's mental health charities. You know, when you kind of get on kids TV, you get a lot of charities approach you, and I was kind of thinking, okay, what are the ones that I really want to focus on? And I just realized, you know, I've got a lot of reasons. I struggle with my own mental health a lot. I've got a lot of reasons to be interested in this. There's a lot of ill mental health in my family. So I approached Radio 1 originally wanting to host a surgery, which was on at the time on a Wednesday night. It did used to be on a Sunday. It was known as the Sunday surgery. And I basically sort of got the job doing that alongside Dr. Rada. And then that became Life Hacks. And so
that's
just
pretty incredible that essentially something you've taken has become this very, very popular show.
Yeah, well, I think the idea was to kind of, you know, the surgery was kind of tucked away for an hour on a Wednesday night, which was great. You could kind of touch on subjects that you can't really talk about at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it kind of has a real intimacy when it's that late at night, you know, people get a little bit more deep. But the idea at Radio 1 was to kind of put it on a Sunday afternoon so that you're kind of tricking people into getting that chat that they need to hear, you know, while they're like on a walk or they're doing their Sunday roast or they're in the car on the way back from a hen do. So that was the idea. And yeah, God, I've learned so much about myself through it. I mean, it's just completely, I guess it's completely informed my whole career since then, because I've just mostly done stuff in the world of mental health, and I started training to be a counsellor, and that was kind of through doing that show. So yeah, it's great. Me and Rada always say it's like free therapy. Like, if I'm not having a great weekend on that Sunday afternoon, I'll come in, we'll talk about three subjects. You know, at least one of them will probably be something that I have been through or I'm going through. We get experts on, I get to ask them my own questions. It's great. It's literally like free access to all these people like you, who you can, you know, you can pick these people's brains.
Yeah,
it's so good.
It's incredible to bat ideas off each other and the conversation. What was it that spurred that further interest to follow up with the counselling?
Firstly, I think it was because I was sort of getting books at the time. I'd just done a book, a children's book, where it was an advice book. It was kind of like an agony aunt book, so I'd got children to sort of write letters to me about their problems, and it was sort of me giving them advice. And I did have Dr. Rada in the book as well, and a trained psychotherapist. But I started getting booked kind of to give advice. So like I went on this morning and gave advice about stress around A-level season, and I started to feel a bit like I wanted a qualification to back me up a little bit in that, rather than just speaking from my own experience. So that was kind of a big reason for it. Also, it's just very sensible in this business to have a plan B career. So that was a thought too.
Within the industry, you are known as a bit of an agony aunt.
Yeah.
Do you feel a pressure to sort of always be able to be open and deliver and help people with conversation on the airwaves?
Do you know what? I don't necessarily feel pressure to be open. I'm quite open anyway. I kind of do talk about everything and anything that I'm going through. Sometimes I feel a little bit like I'll be quite honest on my social media about me having a bit of a rough time, and I'll think, oh God, should I seem more like I've got it together? Like, are people thinking, oh God, how can she advise anyone? Like, she's really struggling with X, Y, and Z. You know, sometimes I feel that. And you know what I've realised recently, what does happen? Sometimes you can get bombarded with too much of it. So I'll listen to like loads of podcasts about mental health, and I'm training to be a counsellor, and then I'm reading stuff about it, I'm reading books about it in bed at night, and then sometimes you get a bit too much information, and sometimes you need to just strip it back and go one foot in front of the other, 1 hour at a time, one day at a time, and stop thinking of all these theories. Because it's like every day there's a new thing you're being told you should do for your mind. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes I think we can be bombarded with too much information. So I think sometimes I have to like simplify it a bit.
Strip it back.
Yeah, strip it back a bit.
What is your theory on mental health?
Oh God, it's a big question. I mean, I'm training to be a person-centered counselor, and the theory behind that really is something called congruence, which is basically like honesty and being honest with yourself. And the guy Carl Rogers, who sort of founded that form of therapy, he believes that everyone's problems can be taken back to the fact that they're not being themselves in some way. So essentially, if something's not right in your life, it's probably that you're not being yourself in your relationship, in your friendships, in your job, in your day-to-day life. You're not living sort of truthfully. You're kind of living how you think you should live, or for other people. And I find that really helpful. So I try and be more congruent, we call it, and more honest about how I'm feeling and what I need. But it's hard to do. You know, we spend a lot of our lives pretending to be someone else. We're just sort of trained to do that.
That depth of mental awareness and dexterity, at a certain point, I think can also almost make the process of mental awareness too much, as you said.
Yeah.
Because then you're constantly in this spiral of self-analysing.
Yes.
Pulling in, pulling out. So that's quite an interesting theory in itself. And then the ability to narrow it down to one thing is...
It can get a bit overcomplicated. I mean, I was literally speaking to my own therapist about this morning. I've always, I think, struggled a bit with existentialism. Like, I can remember being a little kid, like a little child, and thinking, like, what's the meaning of life? Like, you know, what are we supposed to be doing? Are we all supposed to just go to work and do a 9-to-5 and have kids and go on holiday once a year? And that's what we do. I remember being a child and worrying about that and thinking, what's my life's purpose? No wonder I've got problems now.
That's mad at that age, though.
Yeah.
That is a situation and a thought process.
Yeah.
So when it comes to your book, is that something you divulge and talk through as well?
Yeah, I think that is probably something I've talked about a lot. I mean, I'm really keen on like early intervention, which is why I'm involved with Place to Be, the children's mental health charity, because I think I really struggled with anxiety really young now, I realised, but I didn't realise at the time. And like when I was a kid, I used to always be like, I can't breathe, I can't take a full deep breath. And my mum would take me for doctor's appointments, they'd check my lungs, I was fine, didn't have asthma. My mum would be like, oh, it's Smarties, stop me having food colourings, no kid wants that. Yeah. And then it was only when I was 17 and went to the doctors with it again that they were like, oh, it's panic attacks. And it's like, why do we wait until someone's 17 to say it's panic attacks? I realise now that it was all throughout my life, you know. It was from being a kid, and I see it in other kids. I meet kids, you know, when I was on Kids TV, I meet kids and I can see the same sort of symptoms in them, you know.
Do you think therapy is for everyone? You mentioned you had therapy this morning.
Yeah, I kind of do. I'm very pro-therapy and I'm really annoying with it because my friends will be like, oh, my life's a mess, like, what am I going to do? And I'll be like, therapy. and a lot of people aren't ready for it. You know, you're not always ready for it. You've got to kind of be ready for it. And also there's different types of therapy and there's different therapists. Like, if you don't kind of gel with your therapist, that's fine. You can kind of get a different one. But I feel so strongly about it. Like, I've had clients myself. Now I see NHS patients now. I have clients because I'm at the end of my training.
Yeah.
And they'll come in and I'll think, oh man, like I can't see any this person changing. Like, I don't know whether I'm qualified to help them. And then like 6 sessions on, like you just start to see like a bit of a change. And I'm like, oh my God, like this has worked. I don't even really know how, but it is working, you know?
That must be so rewarding.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it doesn't happen with everyone. You know, you do get people who stop coming, or you get people who it does feel like perhaps there's not been any progress, or maybe there's just been a tiny bit of progress. But then you get people who completely transform, or people who say, God, this has just been so helpful. And then that makes you, you know, you might be having a bad day where you've had appointment after appointment where you felt like you weren't getting anywhere. And then you get one that just says, this has completely really helped me. And you're like, oh, thank goodness, you know, you have to balance it out.
And through studying yourself to be a counsellor and going to therapy, do the two work together in helping each other? Because you're in a position of self-analysis when you're having therapy and then going into it, does it help you approach the counselling process?
Yeah, I suppose it does. Yeah, it all kind of goes hand in hand. I have to stop myself when I'm having my own therapy now from watching what my therapist is doing.
No way!
From, like, just trying to pick up tips from her. Yeah. And she knows I'm trained to be a counsellor as well. And I always think, I hope she doesn't feel like I'm assessing her work, because I'm not assessing it. I'm kind of like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, I have to stop myself. I'm like, you're not in a lesson right now. Like, you're not watching somebody counsel. Like, this is for you. But this just shows it. Like, even if you are a counsellor, you need counselling. And the thing with counselling is, we don't get that anywhere else in life, because even if you've got, people wrongly think that counsellors give you advice, and that's like actually what we're told not to do. We're not allowed to tell anyone to leave their husband or leave their job, or we're not allowed to give advice, and it's not helpful. Whenever I've been in the counselling room and I've almost dictated to somebody what they should do, and I'm very careful not to do that, but sometimes if you might almost teeter on the edge of it, you see people because like they don't like it.
Yeah.
Because most people know, they know the answer, they know what they need
Guard
to do.
Up.
Yeah. And most people know what they need to do. They just need a bit of help getting there.
So would you say that it's a soundboard? So it's not a soundboard for advice, it's a space for people to speak freely. Saying that, do you not think that you can have that with family, with friends, if you're lucky enough to be in a situation where you can open up and divulge your feelings?
I think the difference is, and this is what's so great about counselling, this is why we don't have this anywhere else.
Yeah.
It's a space to go in and say whatever you want, and you're not going to be judged.
Okay, got you.
And, you know, we train ourselves to be non-judgmental. We do so much training in diversity and inclusion, and we know we really get to a place where we're not, you know, people can come in and say the most terrible things they've done to us, and unless they're confessing to a crime that hasn't been dealt with, we'll keep it confidential, you know.
Yeah.
If someone comes in and says they're going to harm somebody or that someone's in danger, then of course we have to do something about that. But other than that, it's just a confidential space. I'm not going to share that with anyone. I'm not going to judge anyone. I'm not going to have an opinion on it, because I'm not your mum or your partner or your friend. It's just not the same when we talk to our loved ones. They're too involved.
Yeah.
They've got their own opinions about us.
An emotional connection, right?
Yeah, they care too much, you know, that it affects them what you do. You're just never going to, even if you think you can be so, so honest with someone in your life, counselling just provides that space where you can just be fully honest. People have come in and said, you know, people have come in and been grieving somebody and said to me, I feel better now they're gone. I've never been able to say that to anyone. They were a burden. You know, I had an ill parent. They were a burden. And then this weight's just gone from them. And I'm there going, okay, well, that's understandable, you know, and you can't say that to anyone else in your life, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a thing that happens, you know?
I can totally see connect to that. Now, you've spoken very openly on both social media and on the radio about certain situations that you've struggled with.
Mm-hmm.
One of them in particular is binge eating.
Yeah.
Now, binge eating is definitely something that's been brought into the media, I think, more recently. But it's also something that you don't hear many people speaking openly about. What was it that allowed you to take that step and open up and speak about that publicly? Because I believe you speaking out like that has and will help a lot of people.
I hope so. I mean, I kind of sometimes think of it as like the forgotten eating disorder, you know? People always think of anorexia when you think of eating disorders, and there's a big reason for that. You know, it has the highest fatality rate of any mental illness, anorexia nervosa, so it's a very important thing to focus on. But I do think sometimes binge eating is forgotten, and I think that's because probably it's normalised a little bit.
Why do you think it's normalised?
I just think there's probably a lot more disordered eating out there than we know of. So I think, you know, a lot of people who are overweight or obese might be struggling with binge eating. But in the same way we are with alcohol, you know, food is a sociable thing. It's something you just joke about. You're going out, you're having a takeaway, or you're eating all this food, or like, we sort of like glamorize binge behavior.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we really treat fat people terribly. So it's this horrible juxtaposition where, like, for example, when I was thinner, I would post loads of food. You know, I'd be like, look at me, I'm having this huge Nando's. And people go, oh, where'd you put it? You know. And since I've been bigger, I would never do that. I'd be more likely to post a salad because I would hate someone to see me eating all that food. And so there's this horrible kind of juxtaposition of, like, we encourage people to binge eat and to binge drink, but then we really penalise people if they then can't stop that. Do you know what I mean? If it then becomes a problem because they're obese or they're drinking every day. And I just think,
Because there is also a societal pressure to fit in. So I'll give you an example of this. So when I was an athlete, I was very proud to eat clean. The word clean is an interesting one, but I'm just going to use that for reference point in this situation. So, you know, minimal oils, minimal sauces, very basic food. And, you know, I was ripped up, like super ripped up, like an athlete. However, that did not fit into society. It did because I had an excuse, because it was part of my job to be a certain way as an athlete.
Yes.
However then, sliding back into society, post-athlete life, there's always this pressure from people going, well, why aren't you eating the chips? Oh, well, just have a slice of pizza.
Yeah.
Why are you being a weirdo and not having pizza? So I think there's this other contradiction of society forcing you to eat these fast foods to fit in.
Yeah, so eat them, but not too much. Like, oh God, go out with your friends and eat all that food, but God, don't do it on a Monday. Like, you know, but that's not that easy. These things are foods are really addictive, you know. And I mean, I've always been someone, I've grown up with kind of addiction in my family, and I've always been somebody who, you know, never wants to be addicted to anything. And so I've never tried any drugs. I'm very sort of, I was very set on that from the get-go. I've never smoked a cigarette. I drink, you know, and I eat, you know, what we would call crap foods or whatever, you know, junk food. And I think because both of those, like I say, they're socially, not just socially acceptable, alcohol, socially acceptable food we need to eat.
Yeah.
You can't just not eat,
no.
You know, so it can be really hard, I think, to realize you've got a problem with those things, and it can be really hard to help yourself if you do have a problem with it. So I never thought of myself as a binge eater.
Was there a time or a moment where you recognized your own situation with binge eating and accepted that you had a problem?
What's weird is that I'd always been somebody who, you know, would come home from school and eat three packets of crisps, or, you know, two chocolate bars, or, you know, just have a family-sized bar of dairy milk like that. And, you know, I'd always been somebody who could eat that way. And like I say, that is normalised behaviour.
Yeah.
And all my friends ate that way, but I was always slim, so it wasn't a problem, you know? And this is the thing with disordered eating. we only really think that it's a problem when someone becomes really overweight or underweight. And actually, like, what we should be doing is looking at those behaviours before they get to that point, you know? So I'd put on a lot of weight. I'd put on sort of like 3 stone over the space of a year. I was aware of that. I was well aware of that. I was so miserable, you know? Still something I'm battling with now, you know, and I would cry about not being able to fit in clothes, cry when I saw myself on the telly. So I knew I was in a bad place with my weight, but I just thought, I'm greedy and I can't put down the food. I never really thought, oh, this might be an eating disorder. And it only, the moment when I thought, okay, this isn't right, was I had a couple of times of purging and making myself sick when I stayed in hotels.
Yeah, that's scary.
And I'd never done that ever before in my life. And they didn't do very much at all, but one of my sort of binge triggers would be when I would stay in a hotel for work, which happened a lot.
Yeah.
And I think because I was sad, because I was away from home, out of my comfort zone, filming something or recording something, and sort of in this hotel and lonely and what have you, that would be my time that I'd order loads of food, and then I would be so disgusted with myself, I'd throw it all up. And then I stopped and I thought, what are you doing? Like, you've just made a documentary about eating disorders. Like, you know about this stuff. Like, you're in this world of mental health. And it was like this moment of clarity where I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, you've gone too far. And then in Googling sort of bulimia, and I knew I didn't have bulimia because I'd not purged very much at all, I found binge eating disorder. And I was like, oh my God, I fit into all these things. Like, I eat in secret. I'd started to eat in my car. All my binges would happen when I was in a hotel.
For those that don't know, what does the word purging mean?
So purging is when you get rid of the food. So it might be that you take laxatives or you make yourself sick. You know, it's kind of what people do. Traditionally, people who have bulimia will do to kind of get rid of the food, you know. And these eating disorders can tie into one another. You know, you can be a binge eater who doesn't ever purge, or maybe you do. And like all mental health, I kind of think you can have a little pick and mix bag of you know, all different kind of mental illnesses, and eating disorders can be the same. What's interesting is I just made a documentary for CBBC, and I'd spent some time in an eating disorder clinic, and this was all with young girls who had anorexia nervosa. And what was just such a moment of clarity for me was that when they described to me the reason that they don't eat, and the reason that they would punish themselves for eating, so certain sort of self-harm behaviours, I realised all their reasons were the same reasons I binge.
No.
And the feeling of like satisfaction and the feeling of achievement almost, and the feeling of control that they got from abstaining was the same that I got from a binge.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, it's the same thing. We're just doing it in a different way. And I couldn't comprehend how they could abstain from food, and they couldn't comprehend how I would binge, you know?
Yeah.
But it's all come from the same places. We're doing it for the same reasons, and yet we're just manifesting it in a different way. It's a coping mechanism that we've learnt because of whatever we're going through. And it just so happens for some reason mine was to binge eat and theirs was to abstain from eating.
What was it, do you think, that spurred on the weight increase? Because you said you ate like that for many years, you know, the odd dairy milk, a few packets of crisps.
Yeah.
That is kind of cash when you're at school and growing up. So why do you think there was that spike? Or do you think it was because of these moments of loneliness, being on the road, the increased intensity of the workload?
I think that had a lot to do with it. I think staying in hotels had a lot to do with it, because that one night where you're like, I'm in a hotel, so let's get a takeaway, became most nights of the week.
Yeah.
And hey, maybe it's metabolism. You know, when you're younger, they do say metabolism changes. Like, when you get older, you can't keep the weight off as much. Also, I had started taking antidepressants. I started putting the weight on not long after I went on them. And I don't know whether that's why. I don't know if the antidepressants made me put the weight on, or if I just started binge eating when I was depressed, which happened to also be the same time I went on antidepressants, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I do know is that all of that coincided with me becoming a presenter. So I've now done a lot of kind of work in therapy to realise that all my problems started the second I got a presenting job. So I never kind of wanted to be a presenter. I wanted to be a journalist. I trained as a journalist. I wanted to work behind the scenes. And when I was at CBBC, I was working behind the scenes. And my boss one day said to me, we need a new presenter for CBBC. We need a new female presenter. Would you go for an audition? And I was just like, okay, I suppose so. That doesn't sound like something you should turn down. And I got the job. And then so life just sort of changed overnight. I mean, this is CBBC, you know, it's not like I was a Hollywood star. But immediately, like, I've got people saying things about me on Twitter, things about how I look. I had people dictating what I wear. same things about my makeup, same things about my hair, same things about my presenting style. And when I look back now, I think I felt so vulnerable and so attacked, but I was just going along with it. I was just like, oh, okay, this is what happens.
It's quite scary, isn't it?
Yeah, looking back, that was a real trauma. And it's no surprise to me now that that's when I started binge eating to cope. And that's when I sort of got depressed and sort of 8-9 months after getting the presenting job, kind of went on antidepressants and have been on them since very recently. So I think the job has a lot to answer for, which I'm sure is something you can relate to. It has, it's amazing, but it definitely can take its toll on your mind sometimes.
Yeah, it's full on. There's highs and lows, and definitely being on the road, it's not easy. And something in my former life as an athlete, those days being alone in the airport, being bored. I think boredom can be a big thing to do with binge eating as well. But you've spoken a lot about the process and what it is. Have you been able to take and make any action to help balance that out?
Yeah, I have, and I'm not quite there yet. But I followed like a lot of accounts on Instagram that were about sort of binge eating recovery. I follow some amazing people. And I used to look at their posts and they'd say diets are the problem, diets the problem. And I used to think, what? I don't get that. How can diets be the problem? And then I realised it through having sort of counselling and listening to all these podcasts on this subject, that they are. I was doing something called Last Supper Thinking, which I was taught about by a lady called the Binge Eating Therapist on Instagram, which is where you tell yourself, right, this is it, I can't eat like this anymore, I'm a fat pig, Monday, diet starts. And because of that, you're so stressed, without even maybe consciously realising it, you're so anxious and stressed about the deprivation that you know is coming up, you binge. But then when it comes to the deprivation, you can't do it. So I'm constantly having a last supper, never going on the diet. So I'm putting the weight on because I'm constantly in last supper thinking, because I'm going, one day this has got to stop.
Tomorrow.
Tonight. One day you're on the salads for life. You're eating like a rabbit. So, you know, so then my brain's constantly choosing that option because it's going, this is the last time I'm having it. But it's never the last time.
No, I don't think I could eat salad for the rest of my life.
No. And you don't need to.
Just putting it out there, right? It's definitely not easy to find that balance. And I think this is very, very relatable, because it's a topic of everyday conversation, you know, whether it's someone in your family or a close mate, you're like, this is it, this is the last time I'm not having pizza for a month, or I'm not having ice cream.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about. The minute you say no, you want it even more.
Yep, absolutely. And that's happening without us even realizing it. So we don't even think we're thinking that every day, but we are. And actually for me, it's been about going to counseling and finding the reasons behind why I eat the way I do. So the counsellor I see now, she kind of specialises in addictions and eating disorders, and she had me sort of like write a food diary, and the reason for that was to write down what I'm going through emotionally when I'm eating. And there's been so many amazing light bulb moments for me. For example, I've identified why I'm eating too much. It's because I'm thinking, I'm in a social situation, for example, and I'm going, I feel a pressure here to be like fun and funny and jazz hands and, you know, entertain everyone, and eating or drinking sort of helps me with that. Or I'm so scared to be bored. I realise I'm really scared of being bored. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with just being bored and living in the mundane? Maybe because our lives are so high octane.
Super high octane, and I think social media can play a big part in that.
Absolutely.
Everybody's always doing something, everybody's always busy. So being bored is kind of not okay.
No,
and I mean, it is. It's good. It's good for our minds.
Exactly. And now I'm trying to tell myself, okay, so how about you don't be the person that entertains everyone at this dinner table? Like, just try that. Or how about you just sit and be bored then? So be bored. What happens? Yeah. What's going to happen? And instead of reaching for that food to kind of cover up that feeling. And then what was happening was, when I am eating, my thought process is, this is great. I'm not feeling anything. Same as if you're drinking or you're doing drugs or whatever it is that's your thing that gets you out of your head. Eating gets me out of my head. You know, I'm like, this is great. Let's keep on doing this, you know? I had a real light bulb moment when I realised that when I go on holiday, I don't put any weight on. And my family would be like, my mum and my sister would be like, oh God, I've put on a stone this week. And I would feel this guilt of like, I'd be like, I haven't. And I'd be like guilty, because I'd think, that's because I eat like this at home. I eat like this all
come
the
on,
time. Like, I eat like I'm on holiday every week, you know?
And you know what? We're only on this planet once.
Exactly. But what that really taught me about that Last Supper thinking was that the reason I'm not like binging on holiday was because I'm giving myself permission.
Okay.
So when I'm on holiday, I'm like, right, you know, you're on holiday now, eat what you want, drink what you want, and then when you get back, you'll go on the diet. And because of that, I'm not actually eating, overeating, because yeah. I'm like, I'll order at a restaurant like what I'm actually hungry for, and I'll think, I can get an ice cream in a bit if I want. So I've been trying to apply that thinking to my day-to-day life of, nice. You know, permission. And I used to see all these binge eating accounts saying it's about giving yourself permission to eat, and I was thinking, what, that's not possible, I can give myself permission to eat, like I'll yeah. eat everything. But actually, if you just tell yourself, like, you're not going on a diet, you can have what you want, and like, are you hungry right now? Like, listen to your body. That it's about that. And it's harder, like, I'm not there, I haven't lost any weight yet, you know, I'm not there, but I can feel my attitude towards eating changing, and that's the important thing. And that's the important thing with disordered eating, I think. Like, yeah, don't wait until somebody is really underweight or really overweight. Like, let's kind of address the way we behave around food now.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You're winning the approach, right? And it all starts with the approach and the understanding. The crazy thing is that with eating disorders, something like anorexia, you can see it, right?
Yeah.
Whereas binge eating definitely is one of those that is more secretive and it's not seen.
Yeah.
So essentially almost harder to treat because people don't necessarily know or understand about it. So thank you for being so open and honest. Like, I think that will really, really touch a lot of people.
It's a touchy subject, you know, like our bodies are a touchy subject, and I really feel for anyone who just, there's a lot of shame around it. There's a lot of shame around not being able to sort of control binges. You know, I always say people would rather you be anything but fat. You know, people talk about pretty privilege and thin privilege. I feel like I've just seen it. Like, people treat me differently when I'm bigger to when I was thinner. Like, I see it, and I used to read about this. And there are people much bigger than me, of course, who will probably think, God, yeah, we'll try being my size. And I can imagine, like, it's really sad. Like, we are quite a fat phobic society, and that's something I've kind of really, really noticed. So I think there's a lot of shame tied up in getting help as well.
Yeah.
And people just, it drives me mad. I can't tell how many TV commissioners I've said to, let's not do another show about diets. Let's do, like, we can all go on TV and say, this is how many calories you should have. Let's do a show about the mindset. Why can't we do it? Why is the diet industry so successful? Because people have to go back on these diets all the time because they don't work. Like, you know, I just wish there was more on TV and radio about the mental side of it. The reason that we're comfort eating, you know? The reason that people have this out of control relationship with food,
because and the addiction because of the stuff they put in the foods. It was really interesting. We had a great podcast episode with Dr. Zand a couple of years ago about addiction and preservatives,
ultra processed foods and stuff. Yeah,
exactly.